Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that's had Barbie in its name for almost a year now. I'm Jake Mintz, that's Jordan Schusterman. Everyone's freaking out about this movie. We were first, though.
It's true. I feel like we've heard a lot of different pronunciations of our show depending on how they would like to emphasize the B. And yeah, this is great. This could be potentially huge for the brand unintentionally. Everyone's showing up to movie theaters dressed in all pink, hoping to hear what we have to say about Jared Kelnick kicking a cooler. And we are going to deliver that on this episode of Baseball Barbie Cast.
Love to hear that. Baseball Oppenheimer Cast is a much darker production, but maybe that's what we need on this show, considering the downtrodden nature of the Kelnick news. And oh yes, we will get into a little bit of Yankenfreude. The Bronx Bombers are spiraling down, and we will revel. I don't know if we're going to revel in the misery of it, but we'll certainly pick it apart. I have some things, speaking of misery, to talk about. I was in the White Sox clubhouse, and it made me want to drink heavily. And then we will do good, bad, and ugly, and try out a new game called Baseball Taboo. But let's begin in the Seattle Mariners dugout, where Jared Kelnick, zero, water cooler, 250.
Yeah, Jared Kelnick's foot in particular. This was a tough scene yesterday afternoon. For those who did not see, on Wednesday evening, Jared Kelnick came to the plate on to face a very well-rested and clearly amped up Yoan Duran in the ninth inning, down by a few runs. He struck out.
And again, no one throws harder.
Yes.
Then Yoan Duran.
Correct. And Kelnick battles 9-pitch at bat, which I would love to go back and see how many 9-pitch at bats there have been against Yoan Duran this season. He's fouling off 104. He's, you know, fouling off crazy curveballs and then ultimately looks at a curveball for strike three on the 9th pitch of the at bat. The Mariners lose. And apparently Jared Kelnick kicked a water cooler and broke some amount of bones in his left foot, and he will be out for some time. Doesn't sound like there'll need to be surgery, but he's certainly going to be out for at least a few weeks. And so then on Thursday, when he shows up and is just in a walking boot, and it was one of those injuries where it's like, well, that's because it happened in the ninth inning and the game was over. No one actually knew about this when it happened. Everyone's like, so what happened there? And what we saw was Jared Kelnick, basically go and give it to everybody straight. And it was really, really, really hard to watch because he was extremely upset about this. Now, we've seen people have embarrassing baseball injuries many times, heard about them, and everybody chooses to handle it a little bit differently. But you wanted to leave the show with this, I think, for a very specific reason. And I, as a Mariners fan, this is hard enough for me to talk about because just the latest, it is certainly a disappointing stretch. But what were your takeaways from kind of seeing Kelnick's reaction to this? Because I certainly have a few.
I have a lot of thoughts, and I think to properly understand Kelnick's reaction, you have to understand who he is and the path that he has taken so far in his baseball career. For those of you who know this, you can skip ahead. For those of you who don't, Jared Kelnick, right, top pick out of a Wisconsin high school by the Mets, traded to Seattle in the Cano trade, top prospect the whole time, gets up to the big leagues and sucks for parts of two seasons, is just bad.
Really bad.
Really bad. And this
not
is
just happened. Like he always struggling. Like he's the worst hitter. Yeah.
And in some ways, it gets accentuated last year by Julio's success. And I know Kelnick will never admit this, but there's no way it's easy to continually struggle at the big league level when the guy who is one of your good friends, who you were supposed to tag team the franchise to glory with, is one of the most famous baseball players in the league all of a sudden, and you're in Tacoma. That cannot be easy. He comes up at the beginning of this year and figures it out. Like, he figures it out for the better part of 2 months and has been a good player this year. Not as good as maybe we thought he'd be 4 years ago, but a productive Major League Baseball player. So that is the Jared Kelnick tale. The other thing I think is important to talk about here is who Jared Kelnick is as a person and the unique baseball journey that he has been on, like, not emotionally, but, like, he is not Bryce Harper from a conjured in a lab perspective. from a always was going to be this perspective, but it's pretty close, my friends. Jared Kelnick has been training to be a big leaguer since he was 12 or 13. This has been his goal. This is his life. This is all he ever wants to do. Now, the issue I think that he has had in the beginning of his career is that his skill set and his maturity level have not always matched up with one another. And part of that is because he did not have a normal childhood. He told me when I interviewed him, he left prom early, like a middle school dance. I think it was like a middle school prom or middle school dance early to go watch Bryce Harper's debut. Right. And that's cool. But that is kind of an example of Jared Kelnick's high school life, where he maybe wasn't participating in all the normal childhood things that people get to do. And so that has left him somewhat stunted, at least in the beginning of his professional career, from a social perspective. He has made enormous strides in that this year, based upon what we've heard from around the Mariners, but he's still a kid. You talk to him and he comes across a little bit as a child. And that's not a bad thing. What is he, 23?
So he just turned 24 last week.
Right. Like that, sure. You could be a child at 24. We did some dumb shit at 24. I have no problem with that. And so that brings us to last night, where he kicks the cooler. So the first thing that's funny to me, Jordan, is he rolls up and he's like, I got a broken foot. You can't lie about that, right? Because a broken foot, there's usually a moment of trauma to your foot when that happens. It's not like a hamstring or a muscle.
Unless you're like Greg Oden. Right. Like in basketball, if you're gigantic, it's possible you just land and your foot's like, I can't do this anymore. But right. In baseball, generally something probably has to happen.
You can't sidestep this one. Right. Get it? Wink, foot, step. And so he came clean and he handled it about as well as he could have. And I want to get to the response in a second. But I want to talk about Jared Kelnick and the human experience, my friend. I think feeling uncontrollable rage is a very natural human emotion. Mm-hmm. If you have never felt angry, you are not living or alive. And now there are different levels to that, like striking out against one of the best closers in the world when you're making more money probably than most people will ever see, versus like opening your eyes to the horrors of humanity. Like there's a scale there, yeah. But I understand Kelnick's frustration. Like, we've all felt that before, right? But it's about how you channel it. And he clearly did not channel it well. But that brings me to yesterday, where he's crying in the dugout answering these questions. When you do something like that, when you let yourself get the better of you, your emotions take over, one of the things you feel is embarrassment. I think back to, have you ever really lost it, Jordan? Have you ever like had a moment in your life where you really lost it?
Definitely not. I feel like not as an adult. I think it has probably happened to me more as a kid for a reason. But yeah. It's not an experience I'm super familiar with.
So it's happened to me once. During COVID, during lockdown, I just went berserk on my younger sister. And it was when I had just gotten elbow surgery and I was like mad. I cannot remember what I was so mad about, right? But it was like
that's peak usually the case, right?
Yeah, it was like peak lockdown, right? Like, who remembers? Right. And I remember like I threw something and it hurt my arm because I couldn't throw because I just gotten Tommy John. And I think back to that moment, and 2 seconds later, all you feel is shame and embarrassment. And even now, as I think back on it, it's 3 years ago, I feel terrible. You know, like I love my sister, we have a good relationship, but I just feel horrible about it. And to see Kelnick have to reckon with what he did. Now, granted, there was really no victim here besides the cooler and I guess his teammates, right? But to see him reckon with that in public was very raw and very
human. And again, like as you kind of alluded to, like baseball is his identity to a pretty extreme degree as far as baseball players go. And it's interesting to see him have this, like we've seen him have these moments. I mean, he was going like 0 for 40 last year. I mean, this strikeout came in a time amidst a 10 game hitting streak. Like he'd kind of been heating back up in July. Like he has started to find major league success, but with that has come more expectations again and more responsibility to contribute to a Mariners team that is desperately trying to win every single game. And every single game is the most important game for the rest of the season. And so knowing that he can't contribute to that anymore is obviously crushing because that's him. Like, that's all Jared Kelnick wants to do is help a baseball team win baseball games. Like, that is very simple. And he has taken that opportunity away from himself. And that is what is so frustrating, disappointing, and ultimately heartbreaking, because it's like he knows as well as anybody how much this sucks. And, you know, now we'll see what happens, how this, of course, baseball is a silly thing. They'll go and, you know, win 15 of their next 16 for some godforsaken reason. Cade Marlowe is going to hit 600 or whatever, but it sucks. And I hope he can come back. And people say, oh, I hope he can learn from this. This dude's already learned from so much failure, right? Like, he's already been to the bottom of this major league experience. And now this is a new kind of challenge. So, you know, of course, it's easy to say, I hope he learns from it, whatever. Like, that's pretty redundant. Like, he understands how problematic this is. But I think in a weird way, most of the response on Mariners Twitter is like, I love this dude because this guy clearly cares a ton.
That's what I was going to ask you. So last year we had a moment in Philadelphia where Alec Boehm, the Phillies third baseman, was getting booed. And he said, Hot Mike caught him saying, I hate this place. Mm-hmm. And he owned up to it in the post game, and Phillies fans love him now. Do you feel like the response to Jared Kelnick drop kicking a cooler and breaking his foot is somehow good for his approval rating?
Well, it's not that, but it's obviously how he reacted. And also, like, Kelnick's been, it's interesting because people really, really want to see him succeed. And the success that he was having earlier this season was like so much, it was everything you could have possibly hoped for, considering how low it had gotten with him, that like he's already one of the more popular players on the team. And so, like, weirdly, it's both disappointing, but the way that he immediately handled it, I think it's like, also, if you're Mariners fans have been proverbially, you know, kicking coolers all season long. Like, they're pissed, right? Also, so it's like you can understand the frustration. And so as annoying as it is, it's like, oh god, now, you know, they got to watch AJ Pollock more because he lost control. It's I still think that it's the way that he handled it, not that he needed to prove how much he cared, it seems like it played well with the fans.
Well, that's the thing, right? Is fans want the players, their favorite team's players, to exhibit how much they care. They want the players to care as much as they do all the time. And this is related to the Yankees, which we'll talk about in a second. And I think about how, you know, a team's losing by four and guys in the dugout are laughing. It's like, yeah, of course they are. Like, that's how you have to survive in the sport, to not go nuts. But fans can't always have that perspective. And so when a player is able to mirror the emotions the fans are having, I find that to be refreshing for people who live and die with the teams they cheer for. And I think that, like, Kelnick, he's not an idiot. He's immature and he can lose control of his emotions, but he's not dumb. And so crushing him for this is sort of pointless because he knows, like, he's aware that he was an idiot, yes, like 2 days ago, for kicking the cooler. And I think he will learn from this in a really actually more positive way than all the failure, because the failure can spiral you. This, I think, is more of like a real learning moment. So
yeah. Well, Jared, he had Kelnick, that too, right? I mean, it was 2 years of hitting 160. So yeah, I hope we see him again this season, whether the Mariners are in contention or not. I do think that that the strides he made this year are meaningful, and he's clearly capable of being a good big leaguer. And this is an unfortunate derailment that he will certainly learn from.
It's a tattoo forever, right? It's on the Wikipedia page until he dies or the internet explodes. Jared Kelnick on Wednesday, July 19th, 2023, kicked a cooler, fractured his foot. That'll follow him forever. Now, if he becomes a Hall of Fame level player, it'll be a footnote, but it's something be just a little footnote. Hey,
it'll be a note about the foot.
Yep. Note about the foot. I didn't even realize I was making that joke. Jordan, let's move on to the New York Yankees. Baseball team that a lot of people know about. All around the world, you'll see people rocking the Yankees hat, and that's just because they love Oswaldo Cabrera.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I didn't refer to them by their government name. The last place New York Yankees.
So, you know, you could say, oh, well, they're still the better record than the first place Twins or you know, the Angels who just swept them, or the Mariners who had all these expectations, or the Mets. Oh, they're still way better than the Mets and the Padres and, of course, the Cardinals. But as you said, Jake, these Yankees are indeed in last place after being swept in Anaheim by Anaheim in Anaheim for the first time since 2009, I believe, was the year, which is a long time ago. But hey, maybe that's exactly what Yankees fans need to hear. Is going back to 2009, right? I mean, Yankees fans would love to go back to 2009 at this point, because a World Series feels so, so, so far away at this stage for this franchise. And we know that their season has been derailed by many, many, many injuries. But at this point, how many years in a row does that have to happen for us to be like, maybe that's a problem with the roster?
I've said this so many times about them and the Mets. Build the ship out of old wood. Can't be surprised when it sinks.
Josh Donaldson will no longer be playing for the Yankees, it seems. A lot of discussion about that era coming to a close. But as the Yankees sit here, you know, 50-47 on an L4, they are in a very... We did not necessarily include them when we previewed the trade deadline. We said, oh, okay, we're not putting them with the Angels, Mets, and Padres yet, where they could maybe sell. But now it's like, okay, has anything changed in the last couple days? And how do you kind of view their next couple weeks, particularly this weekend?
Well, this weekend is very important because they are hosting the Royals. And the Royals, if it wasn't for the A's, boy, oh boy, would we be just diarrhea-ing on the Royals.
We should be anyway, right? I mean, the Royals were not supposed to be good, but they were not supposed to be the worst. That was not part of the plan.
And they're giving Oakland a run for their money. So the Royals are coming into town. And if the Yankees lose this series, it is a catastrophe. Mm-hmm. The vibe is already awful. And one of the things I saw on like Yankees Twitter people the other day is that it's kind of moved from anger to like total despondency. The hands are thrown up in the air. The hope is lost. Like it's not... No one's fuming. It feels like they're just, like, they have no words. And I get it. Like, that's the thing, man. It's easy to criticize and dunk on Yankees fans for being overly dramatic and having high expectations for their team. But let me say, have you watched this lineup? It's tough.
Yeah, it sucks. Now, what I'm curious about, especially from your perspective, having been around them a lot this year and last year, is, and maybe this is a better question for next week after you spend some time around them this weekend, like, we just did this last year. Now, the difference was that last year, they gave themselves such a head start in the first half. But July and August were terrible last season. August in particular was an awful, awful, awful watch. And this year, but like last year, they still had enough players playing well. Obviously, most importantly, they had the MVP and Judge carrying them. But like, it's amazing how this year there's just so little to cling to. So, so, so little to cling to on this entire team. And for a while, it was still like, okay, the bullpen's really good and Gerrit Cole's awesome. Gerrit Cole has continued to do his job. But like, man, there is just nothing. Like, Anthony Rizzo has been a non-factor for multiple months now. DJ LeMahieu is just downright bad. Gleyber's the only thing they have going for him, and he's not nearly good enough to actually, you know, carry an offense for any substantial amount of time. And then Stanton has also been a non-factor. So I don't really know. Like, Judge, the mystery of when he's coming back, you know, remains. But even if he's coming back, like, sure, you could say, oh, well, he carried them last year. There were other good players last year. There are not any other good players right now with this Yankees team.
And meanwhile, Gary Sanchez is raking in San Diego and Aaron Hicks is crushing it in Baltimore. And that just adds insult to injury. It kind of proves that something is going wrong at the big league level, that the Yankees are not getting the most out of their players in the major leagues. Maybe they're doing a good job of minor league development. That's a different thing. But when you take a look at Baltimore or Tampa, Tampa can just poop out a Luke Rayleigh every year. And if you take a look at Baltimore's roster, all three of their outfielders, Mullins, Hayes, Santander, were on the crappy 2020 Orioles, and those players have gotten better over time. Very rarely does it feel like a player in their late 20s to early 30s is getting better on the Yankees. Now, some of that is probably developmental choices at the big league level, but some of that is like, who are you going to get? Dylan Lawson, their hitting coach, I mentioned this, he was fired right before the All-Star break. How much of this is Dylan Lawson's fault? So little. What do you can't put lipstick on a pig, man. It doesn't matter if you're, you know, Jesus Christ hitting coach. What are you going to say to Josh Donaldson at this point to get him to hit the baseball hard? Or I guess that's the wrong thing. Get him to hit the baseball consistently.
Well, so it's interesting too, because I, was just on a Padres podcast yesterday, and we were discussing the blame pie for them, right? And the three main, arms of like the team, right? The manager, the players, and the front office. And it's this constant question in any level of baseball analysis, where is it like, okay, am I blaming this on the players for underperforming, or am I blaming this on the GM for putting this team together and then them sucking and then us being surprised? I'm curious where, and then obviously with the Yankees in particular, probably more than the Padres, there's a lot more frustration with the hitting coach and Boone and whatever. I always am going to give the smallest amount of the blame pie to the coaching staff. But where do you kind of stand on the, because I feel like this is the most heat Cashman has gotten too in recent years, just for kind of where they're at.
And I've been a Cashman defender. I think it's a very difficult job to be Steinbrenner whisperer. And there's a reason he's still there. I mean, you look at the franchise page on Baseball Reference, man. It's so many playoff appearances. And yes, they have a competitive advantage. I understand that. But Cashman, generally, has built rosters good enough to get to the playoffs. Yes, he's done it with a bucket of money, but he's still done it. As we've seen this year in San Diego, New York, it's pretty easy to fail with a bucket of money. Mm-hmm. That can happen.
Yeah.
That being said, I think the Yankees front office is behind the eight ball. I think the lack of change there is an issue, that they have a lot of catching up to do. And I think there is some blame that goes to the Yankee mystique. And let me explain what I mean by that. There is an expectation in New York that you have to be good every single season. That is the reality of playing in the Bronx, of running a team in the Bronx, of managing a team in the Bronx. But what that does is it makes you uncomfortable giving playing time to young players when they need it, right? And so then you go out and get a Josh Donaldson instead of having someone play every day. You go out and you extend DJ LeMahieu, right? Now, on the flip side of that, they didn't go out and spend money on one of the big name shortstops in free agency because they wanted to give the keys to Volpe and Peraza. And I understand that there's layers to it, but it's like they've made the wrong decisions. They have gone out and targeted the wrong veterans at the wrong times and not given enough run to the right guys coming up. And so I just think there's a little bit of rottenness in the whole thing. Jordan Schusterman, the New York Yankees have never finished fifth in the AL East ever. Ever. The AL East in its current incarnation has been a thing since 1994, right? And they've never finished last of 5 of 5. Never. And they have not been under 500 since 1995, the year we were born. I was not on this planet. Year. I guess I was a month old.
Not under 500 that year because they didn't finish the season, but 90.
Oh, true. 90, true. Sir,
91. Again, not your fault. You were being born in September. So,
well, I just saw 79 wins and made a call.
So, yeah, obviously, so 1992, last time they finished under 500. And also, but this is the other thing we mentioned, all these other teams, like the fact that it's this bad and they're still over 500 now is also a testament to how, what the standard is. Like, they still have put together a pitching staff that can put them in position to at least win a certain number of games, and they could still win 86 games this year. Is that going to be enough? Is that how you're going to make you feel good after last year? No, of course not. They should still be. I'm not saying fans shouldn't be pissed. Are you asking me if they're going to finish in last place? No, but it's going to be close. I think I love that here we are with the Red Sox and Yankees just trying to avoid the bottom. That is a wonderful baseball reality to live in, I gotta say.
It's a very nice change of pace. Mm-hmm. I'll say that.
Not mad about it.
Not mad about it. Yank, just quickly before we take a break, I want to talk about our friend being a dummy.
Yeah, I was going to say, this is probably what people thought we might be leading with, but like, I don't have that much to say about it other than it's funny and it's not surprising. What are we talking about, Jake? Carlos Rodon, former guest on this here baseball podcast. After getting a little bit rocked over there in Anaheim.
A little bit rocked. He got rocked.
He got rocked. He got rocked. Certainly, by what they're expecting of him, he certainly got rocked. And I guess he heard something that he didn't like from some fan in beyond the Yankees dugout. And he decided to send him a little smooch from a distance and say, thanks. Thanks for the support. Seems to be the message. This is something that I'm not surprised has happened, although to see it happen, A, on the road, and B, in what his third start or fourth start is like, damn, this didn't take very long, huh?
The simple take here is that if you play well, it doesn't matter. If Carlos was coming off four great starts and had pitched well for the first half of the year, and he did this, people would be like, that's the type of energy we need out of our ace. And instead, he's been hurt and generally bad so far. And so he blew a little kissy kiss, and it looks bad. Friend of the show, someone I spent a lot of time with at the yard, Brendan Cuddy, who is the athletic writer for the Yankees, quote tweeted the gif of this or the video of this and said, this is not good. Here's my take. This does not matter. All that matters is how he pitches. That's it. It's that simple. This is the guy you paid for. If you watched closely to Carlos Rodon playing over the last couple years, this should not shock you. Okay? He is someone who constantly is yelling and cussing on the mound and making faces. He is emotive in a way that when he's good is invigorating and when he's bad is childish. Mm-hmm. And that's that.
Yeah. And we talked about how he was going to have kind of a tough assignment coming in here at this stage of the season and having to play savior every fifth day. And it certainly has not been that so far. Is he the reason they're in the place that they are? No. As we mentioned, they can't hit at all. But he's certainly not helped matters so far. And hopefully for his sake and the team's sake, he can at least start turning in some quality starts in the near future.
I'm excited to go to the yard today and get the lowdown on this entire situation and then share none of it on the air. Let's take a quick break, Jordan, and when we get back, we will do the good, the bad, and the Orioles.
This is former PGA Tour winner Smiley Kaufman, host of The Smiley Show, a SiriusXM podcast. You want to know what I love about golf? I get to talk to some really cool people. I get to walk the fairways of the best courses in the world with the best players in the world. And I get to share it with you every single week. Listen to The Smiley Show right now on Stitcher, Pandora, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts. That's Smiley, S-M-Y-L-I-E.
And we are back here on Baseball Barbacast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman. A little bit of tales from the yard. Jake and Jordan, here's why our podcast is different from all those other baseball podcasts. There are no other baseball podcasts hosted by people who are in locker rooms all the time, who are at the field regularly and enjoy themselves. Maybe one or two others. There are people who have a good time. And there are people who go to the yard. But no one does both as well as we do. Simple as. Sorry for tooting. Sorry for tooting our own horn, but you know, you gotta live confidently. I was in the White Sox clubhouse 2 days ago in Citi Field. Mm. I have never felt a worse vibe. Mm. Now, granted, they had lost 11-10 the night before, which is not a great hangover. But boy, oh boy, Jordan, I mean, it made the Mets clubhouse feel like the 1986 Mets clubhouse. Brutal. And you've been in sad clubhouses before. But the clubhouse of a team that sucks, like the A's, is actually kind of fun because they're not idiots. They know that they're not good.
Yeah, and there's no expectations. There was nothing... Like, there's a difference between sad clubhouse and, like, kind of defeated clubhouse, if that makes sense. Like,
yes.
Like, a post-game after a loss is different than just, like, the midst of a season that is so far gone that every day is like, damn, like, we blew it. Like, we are all disappointing a lot of people all the time. Whereas Oakland, they knew on opening day, like, this is going to be a struggle, and we're just going to do our best to enjoy ourselves, even though we're going to lose 100 games. I saw the White Sox in the beginning of May in Cincinnati when they were, you know, 11-22, and it was already like this. So I can only imagine, you know, a couple months later when we're 51-47, what we're feeling like.
Because this time of year, this is the real death. Because when they trade the pieces away, it is not just losing a bunch of baseball games. It is admitting that the season was a failure. And in the context of the White Sox, it is admitting that the entire window of contention was a failure. When they trade away Lucas and probably Lance Lynn and one or two other guys, yeah, they could come back and sign some people and compete next year and whatever. But you're admitting that it did not work. And that is very tough to swallow.
I will say, though, I actually feel like there's some level of liberation once you do make those trades.
I agree, but we're not there yet.
We're not there yet, exactly. And that's what I'm saying. So, like, this, I agree with you, like, this month leading up to it, where it's sort of inevitable, but we haven't exactly made those decisions yet, and you don't know exactly how many of the guys are going to be gone. You know, I think about the Cubs, right? I think about how the Cubs have kind of treated the deadlines recently, where... you're like, will they, won't they? And by the way, the Cubs are also heading towards a very similar deadline once again with some of their guys, which we should probably talk about next week. But I agree with you. It is the most difficult time because there's a version where they trade a bunch of these guys and then, you know, maybe they call up some younger dudes who maybe you don't know, but it's like then the expectations are lifted off. We've accepted the season as a failure, and now we're just trying to get through the rest of the season, see what we have, and try again next year. But right now, it's just you're marching towards, you know, like the final conclusion of like, all right, who's really going to be here and who's not? And we'll have that answer probably in the next week or so.
I felt like I needed to put on a good vibes KN95 to wander through the fog of despair inside the White Sox clubhouse. All right, let's change the mood, though. Mm. Let's get into the good, the bad, and the ugly. One thing good, one thing bad, one thing related to Dan Ugla, a.k.a. funky, weird, and different. My friend, Jordan Schusterman, why don't you start us off? What's
Jake,
good?
My good this week is Chaz McCormick.
Oh, my
Chaz
God.
Chaz McCormick has a 903 OPS. Now, he has not played in every single game. He's only played in 57 games. But this makes me think of a lot of things. First of all, it's, oh, like the obvious things, of course the Astros figured out. But like, I felt like I had a pretty good sense of what Chaz McCormick was, which is clearly a useful, decent player who bats eighth on a good team and plays some good defense in the outfield. We've seen that in the postseason, right? That's great. That's a gigantic organizational victory for someone who was a 21st round pick out of a Division II school, right? That is great. He's already delivered so much more than you ever could have possibly hoped for from that player. And now I'm like, holy shit, like, is this guy, you know, an all-star level hitter? I mean, probably not, but he's got 12 homers now in 57 games. He had 14 in each of the last two seasons and over 100. And this could not come at a better time because the Jeremy Peñas and Jose Abreu and even Bregman, like, who have not taken the steps forward, this has done gone a really long way to kind of keeping this Astros offense humming in a really impressive way. So maybe this is a fluke and maybe this is just going to keep him. He's going to stay hot. And then once the guys who we expected to be good come back to being good or get healthy, whatever, he kind of falls back to being average. But if he is anything close to this, that is a gigantic development because I thought I knew Chaz McCormick was just kind of a normal, decent player and not a 148 OPS plus guy.
Life comes at you fast, sometimes in a good way. My good is the first place. Baltimore Orioles. The first place. Baltimore Orioles. Hmm. Oh, my God.
Feels good, man.
Wow, it feels really good, Jordan. Mm-hmm.
That's all you got?
It's great. It's good. I mean, like, I got people texting me. I got my parents watching all the games saying, hey, they win, go O's. Like, it's good, man. First place. That's it. That's all I got. First
better.
Place.
I mean, last year was cool, but first place wasn't exactly a discussion. It was more of just like, oh my God, we're not going to lose 110 games, right? I mean, that alone was a huge victory. Yeah, no, the Orioles are really good. And we should talk about the trade that they made because they acquired Shintaro Fujinami from the Oakland A's. I swear I literally said they should trade for him on the podcast, but I don't believe it must have been before we were on the air or something. But I was very, very glad that they took my advice that I threw out into the ether. And let's talk about Shintaro Fujinami because this is a player that we have sort of disagreed on over the course of the season. And it was very funny because I understand no one's watching the A's for everybody to tweet the same kind of stat at the same time after the trade, which is like, his ERA is really high, but his ERA has been really good for the last 2 months. It's like, yes, yes, I know. Because I will say, as someone who basically actively tunes in whenever this guy's pitching because he fascinates me so much, it is a wild, wild, wild ride. I would say there is a very, very small number of pitchers who have this kind of pure arm talent as Mr. Fujinami, as you will now all see in high leverage situations, for better or for worse. But like, it's obviously 20 or 30 grade command, and that came back to hurt him a ton early in the season, where he was either walking everybody and then throwing a fastball down the middle that was getting crushed, or it was just such a mess that, you know, he was pulled before any sort of outs could be recorded. But before I get back to Fujinami individual, like, how are you feeling about this as an Orioles fan? Because this we said, right, they probably needed to add another bullpen guy behind Cano and Bautista, or at least the head of Cano and Bautista. So what are we thinking about him maybe being that dude?
I have no idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, it could be a disaster. It could be great. But it's worth the chance to find out.
Oh, yeah.
And what I like about this move is it is Mike Elias saying, let's do a thing that we're not sure about. So many of the Orioles' moves have been not necessarily conservative, but rooted, predictable, like Adam Frazier. Right, you know what Adam Frazier is. You know what you're getting. Even Aaron Hicks, I mean, you knew that was going to work pretty quickly once they fixed the swing, and he doesn't swing at balls, and the O's love that. Fujinami, I mean, what the heck? I guess the thought here is, who is similar to Fujinami physically? Felix Bautista. Sort of, right? Big-ass dude.
Wait, no one's physically similar. Stuff-wise?
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, big dude, no idea where it's going. Maybe we can sprinkle a little pixie dust on this, right? And if it doesn't work, you spend a lower level prospect on it. So I think it's a nice move. I have no issue with it. But the important thing is the Orioles are in first place. I'm not sure if you heard that. Gunnar Henderson is incredible.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
and I would like to... The Gunnar Henderson-Corbin Carroll conversation will go on for many years, and I'm excited for that. Jordan, what's bad, though?
This one hurts my soul. It's Byron Buxton.
Oh, no.
Byron Buxton, who, when I was, you know, writing about Edouard Julien and seeing him, you know, kick the Mariners' ass over the weekend and seeing how he's kind of emerged as really an impactful Twins hitter, which they've been desperately looking for. We know that Carlos Correa has underwhelmed, and we know that Joey Gallo has been hot and cold. But Byron Buxton, who has not played a game in center field this season because he was going to DH to stay healthy... Well, he stayed healthy, and he has a 685 OPS. And more notably, he has won for his last 35 with 18 strikeouts. I believe he is like 0 for 25 or something. This sucks because, like, it felt like Byron Buxton had done enough in recent years to convince me that, like, if he's on the field, he's going to be one of the best players in the league. And now I have no idea what to make of him. And it's also because it's like before we'd be like, oh, well, maybe he's still hurt. And in this case, I know he had offseason surgery, so maybe that's still hampering him. But like there have been flashes earlier this season where it's like, oh, yeah, like he could do this. I don't know, man. I'm really fascinated what the long term plan is for him. Maybe this is just the ultimate funk and he can heat up again. But like this is not a sustainable DH level of DH production. That's for sure.
Just put him in the outfield and maybe that'll. Wake something up.
Maybe. I have no idea. So super weird. Makes me sad and it is bad. There you go.
My bad is Ellie De La Cruz related. How could that be, Jake?
No, that's okay. Yeah, is it his toot plan? Ellie De La Toot plan?
No, I don't give a crap about his toot plan. His toot plan, him getting thrown out on the bases is just part of the deal. Like, that's going to happen. He's going to have some weird ones so that he can give us the good ones. But here is what I want to say. I have seen a style of tweet the last couple days from a number of different fan bases where along the lines of, if Ellie De La Cruz did this, people would be freaking out about it. Or, wow, MLB tweeting about Ellie De La Cruz too much gives some love to the Brewers. That's not the point, everybody. Ellie De La Cruz is not as good or valuable as the best player on your favorite team. Probably.
Not yet.
He is not yet. He is not better than Gunnar Henderson. He is not better than Julio, probably. He's a fun player to watch who is solid for a child learning how to play baseball at the big league level, right? But what he is that no one else in the world can say is he is breathlessly entertaining. And highlights and clips and tweets and whatever are about that. The Brewers are boring to watch. They're good. That's a good team. And maybe I should be giving them more credit. But they cannot compare to Ellie De La Cruz from an entertainment perspective. You know who's going to be laughing longer? The Brewers, when they're playing in October and Ellie De La Cruz is on vacation. But as far as we're talking about what it means for the sport, I was in the airport recently and there was a kid in an Ellie De La Cruz jersey in New York. Okay, that is cool. That's fine. We don't have to be jealous here. The national media giving Ellie De La Cruz a lot of attention is because he's fun as shit. Simple as.
Yeah, and if you can't see that, like, that's a you problem. That's fine. It's not, I know, like, again, like you said, it's about the highlights. It's about what's going to get attention and the things that he's doing is going to get attention. Like, if you... Sure, you can be like, okay, yeah, but so-and-so's, you know, WRC plus is higher than his. So why aren't you posting about his very normal RBI double? It's like, because it was a very normal RBI double. That's why.
Correct.
It wasn't some shit we've never seen some player trying to do. So I totally agree with you. And it's a little unfortunate. I mean, whatever. We literally just did this with O'Neill Cruz last year. And Ellie's been more productive than O'Neill was at the time. So, These are weird things to get upset about. I agree with you that that reaction is indeed bad. We move to the UGLA, Jake, and I wanted to talk about this on Wednesday, but I think it fits wonderfully into UGLA, and that is the ejection of Blue Jays pitching coach Pete Walker. So what happens here is Alek Manoah is going through it, having a tough time on the mound. And Pete Walker goes out for an ejection, or for an ejection, Pete Walker goes out for a mound visit. He didn't think he was going out for ejection. And he is talking to Mr. Manoah. He's saying, well, we don't know what he's saying, right? But we see he's covering his mouth, as pitching coaches love to do. And because very standard thing you see is that as, you know, the visit progresses, eventually the umpire, the home plate umpire, will walk to the mound and kind of break it up and say, all right, guys, that's enough, right? All right, guys, go back to your positions. We need to resume the baseball game. And that is, of course, even more pressing now with the pitch clock and pace of play, whatever. So umpires are really making sure that the mound visits don't take forever. Great. I support that. That's not, it's not fun to watch everyone, you know, huddle on the mound for a minute and a half. So I agree with that. Whatever. Here comes Malachi Moore, the umpire. He comes up. And what you see is that Pete Walker is not even looking at him, but Pete Walker is saying something still with his mouth covered to Manoah. And Moore comes up, and it seems that Malachi Moore appears to hear something and throws Pete Walker out of the game. This is one of the more unique ejections I've ever seen. I have a lot of thoughts about how this happened, but what was your initial take on seeing this clip and what it made you think of?
I mean, I think Pete Walker wanted to get ejected.
And well, okay, so how did he get ejected? So explain.
Maybe he didn't want to get ejected, but he was also going out there to make a point. Like, I think he felt more, I'm not blaming him. Like, I think the biggest issue here is that the umpire goes out to the mound way too quickly and lingers and listens to the conversation that they're having in the mound. And that is a huge no-no. That
okay, is but this is what I wanted to talk about. Because I feel like we see this all the time. Like, I always wonder what it's like. Like, I don't think it's that. You say it's a huge no-no, and maybe that's true. But, like, I feel like it's a pretty standard thing to see the umpire come and stand next to be like, all right, guys, move it along. And it but doesn't he does even it seem right like he really
away.
Lingered.
He does it right away. Like, if you watch the clip, Walker goes out there, and Moore is, like, at the mound, like, 4 seconds later.
Sure. I mean, the exact timing of it, I'm not 100% certain of, but like he wasn't lingering there. Like he walked up and basically immediately tossed him. So not, but again, what's interesting is it doesn't seem like it was because he was taking too long. It seems like it was because of what P. Walker said. But did you see what Alec Manoah's quote was about what P. Walker, because they asked Manoah, I guess they didn't, I don't know if we actually heard from P. Walker or from Malachi Moore, but Manoah said, this is from Keegan Matheson, the Blue Jays reporter for MLB.com. Alec Manoah on Pete Walker after a pause to pick the right words. Quote, I don't think anything Pete said would have gotten you kicked out of a 10-year-old travel ballpark.
Incredible.
So he's saying like, whatever, he couldn't have possibly done anything. I imagine it was just
like the zone was terrible.
Right. But like, is he saying, he wasn't talking to him. That's the other part. It's not like Pete Walker turned around and said something to the umpire. That's why I'm fascinated by this.
Yeah, I agree, but I think he knew he was there.
So you think he knows he's there and he's saying like, this ump, you know, has been fucking you over all day. And then like, that's how you get tossed. Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm intrigued by the umpire mound visit interaction because I think it is one that I've often thought about. Like if it's a situation, like what if it's not as like offensive where it's like the pitcher's like, or the ump's like, or sorry, the pitching coach like, hey, like this ump is giving you inside. So you need to be pitching there because he's giving you that spot. And if I'm the umpire and I'm hearing that, I might be like, screw you. I'm not giving you that shit anymore. Like, I didn't even realize I was doing that. So I'm curious like how those interactions, you could apply this too to just like catcher umpire interactions also. But this one was a little bit different. Anyway, that's my ugla. What's your ugla?
Okay, so last night during the Rays Orioles game, during the broadcast, the Rays kicked it to the sideline reporter and she was in the stands. And there she was, or maybe she wasn't in the stands, but she was doing like a little hit on
Trisha
a fan.
Whitaker. She's great.
Trisha Whitaker. Thank you. Mm-hmm. She is great. Does a little thing on a fan at the game who is 106 years old. Gentleman is a World War II veteran, which by the way, World War II vets, Jordan, thanks for getting us out of there.
No, big time.
Like
big time.
That
big time,
like we're selfish as Jews, but like, man, huge. Shouts out to all the World War II vets at the Trot.
Well, and again, like there's not that many World War II veterans left, right? Like this is a literal dying breed, obviously, right?
So they roll my guy up to the Trot for a little O's Rays action on a Thursday evening, and they drop this tidbit late in the segment that this gentleman whose name, I think his last name was Monfort.
Yeah, hopefully not related.
Hopefully not related to the Rockies owner. This gentleman had never been to a baseball game before in his entire life.
Or a Major League Baseball game.
Major League Baseball game. 106 years old, and he had never been to a Major League Baseball game. And for some reason, he was like, Thursday sounds great.
Right. Like, well, the crazier part, too, is well, one of my favorite parts of the clip says, all right, so he did this, and he was the first person to tell his infantry about Pearl Harbor and all these crazy fun facts. And then Trisha says, he moved to Tampa in 1964. This dude's been in Tampa like
twice as long as the Rays.
Yeah, triple the time that the Rays have been there, right? And this is what it took to get him out. I agree with you. It is fascinating that this was really the game he really decided, like, yeah, I think it's time to go. It's time to go check out this. I mean, Tyler Glasnow is hot right now, so I can understand that.
Here's my favorite part about this. He's never been to a baseball game before, and his first game was at the Trop. Mm-hmm. And so here he is. He's going to be like, oh, yes, a baseball game in a weirdly lit dome. That's ball, baby.
Born in 1916, That is 1916, just for reference, is the World Series was the Red Sox over the Brooklyn Robins with Babe Ruth on the mound. And he had zero hits in five at-bats, but he did throw 14 quality innings, only allowing one earned run. So this homie, Babe Ruth on the mound, yeah.
This homie is older than Ted Williams.
That's, wait, seriously? Oh man, that's great. Anyway, I hope he enjoyed. I hope he enjoyed the Orioles' victory. Maybe now he, you know that they say, oh, you know, I went to a game and I saw this team and I was hooked, and now
that was it. I think
Bill's gonna say, I'm a lifelong Orioles fan. You know, that's it. Like I'm in for the Orioles now. Even though he's been in Tampa forever, now he actually, you know, if the Orioles go to the World Series, like we'll have to bring him out. Because, like, that's all he knows is the Orioles winning.
He's like, whoa, Felix Bautista, this is crazy. All right, Jordan, let's wrap it up with something new.
All right, let's do it.
We're going to try out a little game piece here. Here's how this is going to go. All right. If you've ever played a game called Taboo, then you know the vibe. If you've ever been to any brewery, this game is probably available in the corner of the brewery on a shelf somewhere. You will see people playing it. The gist is, the real game, I'm trying to get someone to guess a word, and in doing so, I cannot use picked out words in that process. And the way we're going to do this is for baseball. Here's the
deal. That's good. I'm glad we're at least keeping this baseball. Whew.
It's not football. I have a list of 10 baseball players that was sent to me by our super producer, Brady Gardner. Mm-hmm. Jordan has not seen this list. I have not even seen this list. I am going to try to get Jordan to guess these 10 players as quick as possible without saying any MLB team name, any position, any countries, or any divisions or leagues.
I also think probably no city names as well. Or what do you think?
No major league city names. Yes.
Yeah, like descriptors in that sense. All right. Well, we'll see how this goes. I'm very, very curious how this is going to play out. I do. This will be testing a lot of different things here, so I'm excited to give it a try.
We have not done a trial run, Jordan. I'm starting the clock in 3, 2.
What was the clock? Oh, wait. What's the clock? What are we counting?
I just want to see how quick we can get through 10.
Okay. We're kind of like, this is more like timing ourselves so that the next time we do this, we see how good. Okay, I got it.
Okay, 3, 2, 1. All right, first one. Ooh, okay. Wow. He has been inexplicably outstanding this year. He is an offensive player who was just like a big, hulking, horrible slugger who had an OPS around like 50, and this year it's been like 132 for a good team.
Big.
He has an Irish last name.
Oh, Ryan O'Hearn.
Yep. okay, was in a blockbuster trade that happened right before the 2020 season involving an East Coast and a West Coast team.
Okay.
And he went from west to east, and he's just been like a good everyday player this year.
Francisco Mejia.
No, further north.
I have no idea.
Oh, he was, I believe he was drafted at the University of Houston.
Okay.
Undersized for his position.
Nope. I was going to say Dres Barrera, but I think that's wrong.
Can I say another player's name?
Sure. I don't know.
He was in the Mookie Betts deal.
Oh, Connor Wong.
Yeah.
That's too much of a hint. That's a good one. Yeah. Though.
Okay. Oh, I don't. This one I can't do. Matt Wallner. I can't do Matt Wallner. Sorry. Has a tattoo.
You can't do Matt Wallner. Damn, you don't even know ball, dude. You
give yeah, I don't know ball.
Yeah, sorry. Go ahead.
This next guy has a tattoo on his leg of the Florida Complex League.
Oh, the GCL. Mickey Boniac.
Mickey Boniac. This guy played at Cal and was an all-star.
Ooh, was an all-star. Marcus Semien.
Marcus Semien. Ooh, Big Dumper.
Mr. Cal Raleigh.
Ooh, okay. Pitched for Team Mexico. Oh, I can't say country. Shit. Okay. I'll try it a different way.
Okay.
Taiwan
Walker.
Yes. okay. This guy is from an abnormal or slightly bizarre baseball country. Or no, he's not. But oh, he's from a common baseball country, but his first name is spelled in a way that makes you think he's from a slightly more bizarre baseball country. Okay, let me. That's a bad descriptor.
Oh my God.
Who is the I can't say position. Shit. Who is the greatest defensive outfielder of the last 30 years?
Okay, so this is somebody from Curaçao. And or it's not somebody from Curaçao.
Yeah, not someone from Curaçao, but his first name is Curaçaoy.
But his first name is Curaçao. I don't know.
He's a rookie.
Is it Chadwick Tromp? No, he's from Aruba. He's a rookie. Okay. Man, I have no idea. I mean,
Andrew Monasterio.
Oh my God.
Okay. D-R-U-W. Okay, two more.
Yeah.
Twin. This guy's a twin.
He is a twin. Tyler Rogers.
No.
Taylor Rogers.
Yes.
Okay.
Last one. This dude
Andrew Monasterio. That's a great name.
This guy is from an aforementioned country that we were talking about. You said this country.
Okay.
This island, he said.
Okay. He is from Curaçao.
No, he's from the other one.
No, he's from Aruba.
Yeah.
And his name is Xander Bogaerts.
Yeah, there we go. Yeah. Four minutes. That was brutal. Ooh. That was brutal. Matt Wallner was tough.
Matt Wallner, I probably would have, I don't even
How
know.
How would you have done that?
There's a lot of them, a lot of guys like him on his team already, and he has not been one that has become the most productive.
He is on a team that needs
about Matt Wallner.
He is on a team that needs good hitters, and yet he is not hitting.
yeah, I would give us not been one yet.
I would give us a 5 out of 10. Those were some tough ones. Like, how would you have described Connor Wong other than in the Mookie Betts trade?
Yeah, no. It was a good one. And if you can't say position, that one is super tough. University of Houston. Yeah, no. That's a pretty solid. We have had, given Connor Wong a shocking amount of discussion on this podcast. So,
and then Ryan O'Hearn, you nailed that. I mean,
slugger,
Irish name.
I like my Taiwan Walker win because it was like, oh, see, you might not think he pitches for Team Mexico, but boom, in your face. So there you go.
All right, Jordan.
That's it. We did a podcast.
Again.
Thank you all for listening to this Friday edition of Baseball Barbie Cast. Go check out the Barbie movie. Just kidding. We don't care if you watch that or not. You can email us at baseballbarbiecast@gmail.com. That's barbcast@gmail.com. If you want to reach us there, maybe we'll hit some emails next week. Quickly looking ahead to the weekend, Jake, any series that you are especially looking forward to besides Yankees and Royals?
Just Yankees Royals.
We got Blue Jays Mariners. That's certainly a big one. D-backs Reds. We'll see if I make it down to Cincinnati for any of those games. I will say the Padres are entering an interesting stretch here because they've got the Tigers and Pirates coming up. So if they are going to make a move ahead of the deadline in the positive direction, now would be the time to make that happen.
Same thing with the Angels, who have Pittsburgh and then Detroit, I think.
Yes. Dodgers Rangers, also a very, very nice little series there. All right. I think that's going to do it. Thank you all for listening. Have a wonderful weekend, and we will talk to you all very soon. Bye-bye.
SiriusXM Podcasts.